Okay. Let's get started. Hope everybody had a good Thanksgiving and all that kind of stuff. Any questions about anything? Last class was sort of the end of our unit on protein, basically proteins, and we had some guest lectures on, you know, protein docking and protein databases and things like that. Any questions or comments on proteins, or we put proteins behind us? Okay. So what I'd like to talk about now, and which will be really the topic for the rest of the semester, is to start a unit on basically analyzing evolution, okay? You know, basically the algorithms for sort of algorithmic problems in reconstructing evolutionary trees from observed data, okay? And the basic thing driving first of all, the first thing that's important is that evolution is probably, you know, the single most important principle that governs sort of biology these days, at least, you know, understanding. Evolution governs a lot of things that we have sort of talked about all class, all semester. So, for example, we talked about homology searching. Well, why was homology searching, sort of similarity searching across species, interesting? Well, because we sort of assume that we're all sort of descended from some common ancestor and that species that didn't separate that long ago in evolutionary time probably have relatively similar DNA sequences or protein sequences, okay? And that sort of motivated, you know, a lot of what we did with homology searching and a lot of what happens in biology. So we talk about an evolutionary process, okay? An evolutionary process basically consists of a bunch of what I would say speciation events, okay, where somehow at the beginning there is one ancestor species let's say one ancestor species, and then something happens where there is, let's say, perhaps a mutation takes hold and two sort of subspecies get formed, one presumably being the original. Okay, and one maybe being after the mutation. Okay, and then as time goes by, every speciation event, every mutation event, okay, that is of significance marks the creation, you know, basically splits the population into two subpopulations. Okay, and so the way that I would like to think of evolution as happening is that, you know, you start out with a given population, there's a lot of small events that are happening here. You know, local changes, mutations, nothing interesting happens. But for some reason, at certain events, times in history, the population bifurcates, okay? How might that happen, okay? It's not that suddenly, one day, what was the bifurcation event between birds and reptiles? It is not the case that suddenly, at one point, a reptile flapped its wings and flew, and now we had birds. What probably happened, again, just in ways that I sort of understand it, is that typically you have, fairly often two subpopulations naturally form. So for example, you can imagine across, you know, you have a initial population, part of the population wanders into a valley, okay? That population now is breeding among itself, and certain changes are happening within the population that's happening in the valley that is now sort of isolated from the population that was happening at the top of the mountain. Both of them are mutating with time and changing with time. But over time, the, changes that are beneficial will accumulate, beneficial to people living in the valley, the creatures living in the valley will accumulate in that population. And changes will happen, the mutations that are beneficial or maybe even random will just sort of happen up at the top of the other population. And at some point, when the species have diverged enough, suddenly they could no longer mate with each other, okay? That there's no longer enough genetic similarity between the species that they could, you know, they both drifted, the population has been isolated, they drifted. Now if they try to get together, they can't breed anymore, okay? And so now you have two species that have emerged, okay? And so, in that kind of a way, throughout history, there's sort of new species are being formed, and species are dying out. And what you get left with is a tree like this. Okay? Any questions? Okay? That story of evolution probably people have already sort of heard and sort of believed, or maybe not believed. Evolution is, a controversial thing in some quarters, okay? It's not going to be controversial here. Here we're going to accept that evolution happens and it's a good thing, and it drives a lot of the biology. Any questions about evolution? One thing that I guess to deviate from the script a little bit, about speciation events that I was reading about recently that made this a little clearer to me, was had to do with horses. And, most people know that zebras, you know what a zebra is. It's a horse with black and white stripes. And you know what a horse is, and you know what a donkey is, okay? And you know that probably that if you have a horse that breeds with a donkey, a horse and a donkey breed with each other, they create a mule. But here somehow problems happen. The mule can't reproduce. How many people have heard that? Know that much story about horses, okay? So there's a sort of a desired breed of horses that you can make, but they can't reproduce. And why is that? Well, the basic reason is that somehow that the donkey species and the mainline horse species has over time diverged enough that when you have these kind of problems. And one of the evidence that they diverge so much is the question that horses and donkeys and zebras have different numbers of chromosomes. They look a lot alike. I can look at a zebra and say, hey, that looks like a horse. But zebras have something like 15 chromosomes, and horses have something like 17 chromosomes, okay? So there really is substantial genetic differences there, okay? And that's why you don't have half zebras, half horses, okay? And, so that's why...
What?
Okay. Often what you can do is you can get them to, just like you can have these mules, okay, you can get some weird combinations of animals for one generation, but not subsequent generations. That's actually really what this whole story that underlines the situation with the mule. Now, why is that?
Again, I think you go back to my text here.
But somehow when I think of what is happening in a... When you fertilize an egg, that's how you get one of an animal, right? You have your horse father and your donkey mother. I can kind of understand that there's now this mix of chromosomes that happily is going to divide and produce a reasonable organism. Okay? So that's how you get half things across different species. The problem comes, the reason why mules can't reproduce, is now in the recombination phase, where you take the corresponding chromosome from the mommy and the chromosome from the daddy and cut back and forth and cross over between them. Now there are no longer aligned chromosomes between them, and this crossover doesn't work right. That's why you can start to have weird combinations, okay? But these weird combinations are not fertile, okay? Any questions about that? Again, there are some weird combinations. There have been half lion, half tiger, all kinds of weird combinations. But it tends to be infertile because you don't have matching sets of chromosomes. Any questions? Okay. So the bottom line with evolution is that there is this process that is forming a tree. The leaf nodes, in general, we can think of as being the species, okay, that are alive today, okay, and that the least common ancestor in the tree, okay, represents the branching point between where the birds separated from the reptiles. Was this intermediate species a bird or a reptile? The answer is it was presumably neither. Okay, it was some kind of species that both lines have since mutated and changed, okay, until the point where neither of these are sort of recognizable from each other. Any questions? Yeah. Well, okay, the intermediate species, first of all, there's no reason why they have to die necessarily, but presumably the selection, the natural selection that is happening is in response to sort of changing environmental conditions, changing conditions, okay? And so presumably in whatever ecological niche that this thing satisfied, either this or this is presumably better adapted. Okay? There's no reason in principle why the species can't continue to exist.
Okay.
But presumably for the speciation event to have happened, there had to have been niches, at least, where this was a more beneficial situation than that.
Okay. And, you know, that niche may have been the original niche, or it may have been some other sub-niche. Any questions? Okay.
One other thing that's interesting about these trees, again, one thing that I encourage you to do is, if you have never been there before, is go visit the American Museum of Natural History in New York. This is one of the greatest natural history museums in the world. And the most exciting floor there is the top floor, the fourth floor, where they have dinosaurs. Okay, everyone loves dinosaurs. And they have probably the world's best collection of dinosaurs. And what's more interesting is that they have their dinosaurs arranged according to the phylogenic tree. The evolutionary tree that those dinosaurs were, you know, that those species evolved with. Okay, so the mammals are in one. The mammals are in one ring with the sort of pre-mammals. And what's interesting about it is that they sort of highlight the organization of the rooms are organized basically according to the branching points in the phylogenic tree of these species. And what's kind of interesting is that when you look at those branching points. Those branching points are not the kind of necessarily the kind of big picture items that you would think of, okay, like, oh, grew hair or something like that. A lot of them have to do with differences in skull development. That suddenly, like in one place, there was another opening in the skull, let's say behind the eye. And that permitted, once that hole opened in the skull, then that permitted changes in jaw structure and things like that. So the actual changes here are not, the actual speciation event may have been a relatively internal or structural thing that later just opened up opportunities for evolution on both sides of the tree. Okay, any questions? Okay, so the bottom line is that if you think about evolution, an evolutionary tree is reflecting the history of these speciation events. The key idea, the key thing that people who are interested in evolution want to do is to reconstruct this tree. And reconstructing this tree is a fairly complicated thing. You'd like to, in general, you only have the species that are alive now, or maybe some fragmentary fossil evidence. But basically what you typically have is the leaf nodes, okay? And given the notion that we know what gorillas are and humans and mice and birds and reptiles, can we figure out what the branching pattern was that got us here? Okay, that is sort of the key problem in reconstructing evolution and in algorithms for reconstructing what evolutionary trees, or the technical term seems to be phylogenetic trees. I'll use those terms interchangeably. Okay, any questions? Okay, so what would this interpretation mean? This interpretation meant that there was somehow a speciation event that separated the mammals from the birds and reptiles, okay? And then, you know, depending on, when we think about this tree, we can think of, it could be purely a topological tree, where the length of the edge has no meaning, okay? Meaning that somehow the warm-blooded, the mammal population first, at some point, the mouse split off. At some point, then the gorillas and the humans diverge. Okay? Or we might want to assign weights to these edges. Okay? To tell us, let's say, at what time these events happened. Like maybe mouse split off from humans 60 million years ago. Okay? And birds split off from reptiles. In fact, if we're really reflecting time, birds split off from reptiles far before mouse split off from the rest of the mammals, okay? So we could have not only the topology of the tree showing where did the branches work, but we're also interested in either times on the edges or specifically times on the speciation points, the nodes, telling us when that happened. Okay, that's part of the reconstruction of the evolutionary history of these things. Any questions? Okay? And, it should be clear that it's an important problem and an interesting problem. It should also be clear that it's a hard problem because you don't have these past species to work with. All that you really have in general are the leaf nodes, okay? And you want to try to construct the topology from the leaf nodes. Any questions? Okay? So, again, evolution, the notion of evolution has been, you know, studied for 150 years or so. Okay, a little more than, about 150 years or so. Okay, so that's certainly old science. But what's interesting is that phylogenic trees, the interest in phylogenic trees has increased greatly in recent years. Because there is now a new class of evidence that has been out there. Okay? Before, people would reconstruct evolutionary trees by saying things like, well, look, humans are quite similar to gorillas. Okay? We're more similar, humans and gorillas are more similar to mice, to each other, than they are to mice. So it's probably clear we've got a branch like this. Okay? And basically using sort of, you know, what I would say is studies based on physical properties of the species, you could make some guesses as to which species were closer and further away. Okay? And that was historically how these trees were built. Now, only over the last 10 or 15 years or so has it been realized that there is new evidence to build evolutionary trees on, namely DNA evidence. Okay? One thing that's true is that if humans and gorillas had a relatively recent speciation event, it's not only true that humans and gorillas should look like each other, but it's also the case that human and gorilla DNA should look like each other. Okay? And so, you know, it should be the case that if mice split off from reptiles, from birds, you know, longer ago than they split off from reptiles, the DNA evidence should reflect that. And so somehow one of the things that makes study of evolution very interesting these days is now there is evolutionary data, sequence data, DNA sequence data from basically you can have some state data from any living species. Okay, and you can now use that to try and reconstruct trees. Okay? Any questions? Okay? So now a standard paper in evolutionary biology is, oh, I was interested in the relationship between all of these sequences, these particular subset of species. Did the lungfish split off from the trout before the bass or something like this? I sequenced some lungfish, I sequenced some bass, I sequenced some trout, and then I can try to, based on those distances, run it through a program to reconstruct the most likely tree. Yeah. Well, the question of what DNA you use depends a little bit upon what depends upon what you're trying to do, I think. Mitochondria, and this is where any of my biologists can help me out, okay. Mitochondria have the property that they change relatively rapidly, and I believe they're only passed from the maternal line, okay? Not the paternal line. So if you want to study evolution from sort of the female end of the gender, you need to study mitochondria. Mitochondria are also relatively small, so they can be sequenced relatively well. So a lot of the evolutionary data is on mitochondria, okay? But I imagine that there's no reason why you couldn't also build this based on protein data, you know, analyzing genes. You know, you find genes that are homologous and study that. Okay? So as you'll see, when we get into the mathematics of this, we're going to finesse the question of exactly where did the DNA come from. And our algorithms are going to be at a little bit of a higher level. But we should believe that the DNA evidence is something that makes sense to test for in building these kind of trees. Okay? Any questions? The other thing that I think personally is very interesting is that this notion of the DNA evidence, one of the things you always hear about, let's say, creationists complaining about is that the theory of evolution is a theory, you can't test it, you can't, you know, why should we believe it? One of the things that I find very interesting and believable, okay, and if you want to try to argue with one of these people, is the argument that to me makes the most sense, is that over the first 100 years or so of analyzing evolutionary data, taxonomists had built trees that basically reflected the observed structure that they had. And then suddenly, 10, 20 years ago, suddenly a completely different form of evidence has come out, this DNA evidence.
And there is no reason a priori why the DNA evidence, if there is no evolutionary relationship, if you had a different, class of evidence, there is no reason why the DNA data should confirm the gross structure of the trees you got by analyzing physical features that you had observed. Okay? But in general, the DNA evidence is in pretty good agreement with the trees that people built, at least in the gross scale, okay, with the observed, the observed data before. Earthworms are not suddenly being linked closely to humans, okay? Certainly earthworms are being linked by basic DNA evidence towards the insects, which is what you would sort of have expected. Okay? Any questions? Okay, so that's good. So again, the applications of building these evolutionary trees, there are actually a lot of them. One class of them is sort of pure science. Okay, if you would like to try to reconstruct the history of the world, that's history of species. Okay, you would like to try to reconstruct, for example, where did human populations come from? So one of the big, big and controversial issue is where did sort of humans originate? And there's some general belief that, that from the fossil evidence that humans originated in Africa, okay, and then somehow spread to the world, spread across the rest of the world. But it gets a little bit complicated. There were Neanderthal men in Europe, okay, 100,000 years ago. Okay, and whatever happened to them, were they part of the picture of modern humans or not? Where did modern humans come from? And so a lot of these studies consist of taking a look at DNA samples from different populations, okay, different subpopulations in the world, and seeing how closely what subpopulation is nearest to what other subpopulation. And analyzing the resulting trees you get gives you something to say about where human origins come from. Okay? So this is a complicated business, but clearly an interesting one. So it should be clear that studying evolution is interesting scientifically. It's also important to study medically. Okay? So one of the reasons why people build evolutionary trees is with viruses to track the histories of infections. So AIDS is caused by the HIV virus, and there's several different subpopulations of this virus. There's HIV-1, there's HIV-2, and there's different subpopulations of this virus. You would like to try to figure out what is the evolutionary history of this virus to help you to figure out how the disease goes. Why is one subpopulation doing better than some other population? Reconstructing the history of these viruses is reconstructing evolutionary trees or phylogenetic trees. Any questions? Okay. So it should be clear that it's interesting medically, it's interesting scientifically. It's also interested in, the basic problem of reconstructing given sort of underlying, leaf nodes, trying to figure out how do they relate to each other, is interesting in other fields of study. One place where you hear it a lot is in the history of languages. People want to try to figure out, where is it that, that English came from versus Spanish versus Japanese versus Chinese? Was language discovered at one place? And are all the languages descended from that one original language or not? Okay, and how did this process work? Okay? And so again, what you really want to do then is to reconstruct an evolutionary tree where the leaf nodes are languages. You have some data about how similar pairs of languages are. And to try to figure out how the language is split. Okay? So this is good. Linguists will argue about this all the time. Okay? Any questions? Okay? Two other examples that I think are kind of interesting that I've heard people apply phylogenetic tree analysis to. One is in medieval manuscripts. And so now we have this picture of these monks sitting, in the Middle Ages, copying these manuscripts, okay, these Bibles over and over again. Well, one thing that's apparently true is apparently the monks were illiterate, a lot of them. They were good at copying, but they weren't very good at reading. And so when a monk made a mistake and put a wrong letter, copied a letter wrong, okay, then all the subsequent manuscripts that copied from that one, that letter would be wrong. And so there's a certain class of medieval scholars that have leaf notes or famous Bibles and are trying to figure out which one was copied from which one before that. Okay? A similar notion arises. I've seen analyses of chain letters. You've probably gotten in your mail various chain letters that say, you're getting sent this message and it's, you know, bad luck to break this chain letter, but instead you should send it to six of your favorite friends. Okay? And somebody didn't do it and they got hit by a car. Well, now somebody gathered a collection of all the chain letters they could find, and they were able to, by building these trees, reconstruct the history of the chain letters. Oh, you know, here was a speciation event where they added the idea that the person who didn't send the letter got hit by a car. Okay? And here's where the one where, and this is the branching point where instead of getting $1,000, they got $1,000,000 for sending in the chain letter. Okay? So, this is basically interesting to analyze any historical phenomenon. Any questions about evolution or phylogenic trees, why it's important, okay? Anything like that, okay? Very good. So, if we're going to get into the business of reconstructing evolutionary trees, the first question we really need to ask ourselves is what data do we have in order to reconstruct it from? Okay? So somehow, you know, as algorithms people, we're going to want to solve the following problem. As input, you give me the data about your species, and as output, I give you a tree, okay, that represents the evolutionary history. Basically, there's two classes of data that are applied to evolutionary analysis. They lead to different kind of reconstruction algorithms. This is why it's sort of important. The first measure would be what I would call distance measures. Okay? You have a set of N species, and you can imagine getting a distance data, meaning that for every pair of species, you get a number telling you how far apart they diverge. Okay? How similar they are, how far apart they diverge. Okay? In an ideal world, we might get an estimate of the time that they diverge. Okay? Otherwise, it might not be time, it might just be a distance measure. Okay, so for example, we might imagine that it might be the number of bases changed. Okay, the number of mutations between, a particular gene in a particular species. So in one, we're given as input a matrix of distances. And given the matrix of distances, we want to reconstruct the tree. Any questions? Another possibility is that instead of giving us distances, we're given what I would call feature data or character data, okay? Namely, we're given a table that for every species, where we have on one side of the table the species, and on the other side of the table we have properties. Let's say walk upright. So under human and gorilla, that will get checked. Under a bird, maybe that will get checked. Under, this is human, gorilla, bird, frog, and, insect. Okay, so on the walk upright, I'll say, I can observe this and say, human, gorilla, and bird walk upright, frogs don't walk upright, and insects don't walk upright. What might be another property that is important between species? Yeah? Can fly. Okay? That's a good one. Fly. Well, insects can fly, and birds can fly, okay? But humans can now fly. Okay? Because we have airplanes. But gorillas can't fly, and what? Okay, so I'll take humans away from this, okay? But in this case, what we have here are properties, okay? And based on these properties, we would like to say, can we devise speciation points, okay?
such that we can evolution, that we can explain the current properties of this current species with as little in the way of rediscovery of features as you need. Okay? So if we think about it, okay, in an evolutionary split, okay, let's say that over here, you know, something complicated like birds to fly happens. Okay? It probably required a great deal of evolutionary, you know, of change. You had to evolve wings, you had to do all kinds of things. Okay? We would probably want to minimize the amount of rediscovery that has to happen within species. We have to explain all their current properties. The easiest way to explain your properties is that you inherited it from the previous species. And we want to minimize the number of events that happen. Okay? So,
with feature and character data, our goal is to try to explain these properties using the smallest number of changes or reinventions of things. Ideally, zero. Okay? Any questions? Okay? So both of these types of set data should make sense. Okay? And both of these types of data should realize present certain kinds of problems. Okay? So notice that, for example, if we really are going to respect feature character data completely, we would be led to believe that insects and birds evolved to fly together. Okay, that somehow that there should have been a branching point.
If we really believe that flight learned to fly was such a complicated thing that it could only have been evolved once, then we are forced to put birds and insects on the same branch. Okay, now that's actually not true. Okay, that presumably flight arose independently in birds and in insects. Okay? So in this case, kind of data, a lot depends upon how you select your speciation of, you know, your features. Okay? You have to try to select features that are really meaningful corresponding to splits. Okay? Any questions? With distance-fed data,
somehow, you really need to be able to make a good estimate as to how far apart it has been since the species diverged. Okay? And the quality of your reconstructed tree is only going to be as good as your input data. Okay? Any questions? Okay? So we're starting to get into instances of why this is going to be a difficult problem. Okay? But it should be reasonable. Both of these types of data should seem reasonable, okay, as a basis for building trees from. Any questions? Okay, good. So let's think about trees, okay? Somehow when you're building trees, okay, if you want to build an evolutionary tree, you know, the evolutionary tree associated with a set of species, two different classes of algorithms we can think of for building an evolutionary tree. One might be try to build all possible tree topologies and pick the one that is best. Another is to build an algorithm to give us a tree which avoids searching all possible topologies. Okay? So in order to decide which of these approaches we might want to use, we need to be able to count how many trees there are on a particular, you know, number of nodes. Okay? So in general, let's say it's probably easiest to think of these speciation events as creating binary trees, where you sort of have an input population that gets bifurcated. Okay? You know, in principle, perhaps one subpopulation could have wandered into the valley, the hill, and gone to another planet. So you could imagine conceivably having nodes that are not of degree 2 going out. But in general, thinking of speciation events as bifurcating populations makes sense. So we're talking about binary trees. We're talking about binary trees that have N leaves, because the leaves are the current species that we have. Okay? And we'd like to know how many binary trees can we build on N leaves. Okay? Now there's two, any questions? There's two different types of trees that we're going to be interested in.
basically rooted binary trees and unrooted binary trees. Okay? In a rooted binary trees make a lot of sense to computer scientists. Okay, you've lived with binary rooted trees. This is one where you have some node that is selected to be the root. Okay, it would have a left subtree and a right subtree, and each of these trees are recursively defined as rooted trees. Now, in binary rooted trees, there is no distinction between, unlike binary search trees, which is what we're used to seeing, there is no distinction between the left child and the right child. Okay? Does this sort of make sense? That there's somehow this speciation event that separates the mammals from everything else. There is no reason why the mammals should be drawn to the left and the other species should be drawn to the right. But it does make sense to think of it as a rooted tree, because there's somehow this evolutionary flow that is going downward. Okay? Any questions? Okay, so when we talk about a rooted tree, we mean that it is a tree that contains two subtrees, and each of those subtrees is a rooted tree. Okay? So we can get interested in rooted trees, clearly makes sense on N nodes. Unrooted tree on N leaves, unrooted trees have N leaves, and again have every internal node has degree 3, okay, meaning that it in some sense represents a rooted tree dropped on the table with the root information lost. Okay, we're going to be interested in both kinds of trees. Okay, rooted trees to me make a lot of sense from a sense of evolution. Unrooted trees, I have a harder time thinking about with evolution. Okay? But in fact, it's not necessarily true that that biologists can take a look at species and figure out what was the original branching point. If you think about it, trying to identify what the original branching point is really lifting one of the nodes here. Yeah, one of the internal nodes and saying, that is my root. Okay? So there's a close relationship between rooted and unrooted trees. Okay? But they're different entities. Any questions? Okay? So how many things are there? Well, if you have a binary tree, if you have n leaves, you have n minus 1 internal nodes. Okay? And if you count that right, there's now going to be 2n plus minus 1 vertices, namely the n leaves plus the internal nodes, okay, and, if you count it, there's one less edge than there is vertices. So we can count on binary trees or rooted binary trees how many edges and vertices there are. On unrooted trees, okay, we have n leaves, okay? We have, according to this thing, let's just double check this thing. N minus 2 internal nodes, okay? And n 2n minus 3 internal edges. Because it says the n degree root is contracted to a single edge. So what is the difference here?
If we have 3, if we have a rooted tree, here we've got 3 leaves and 2 internal nodes. If we ignore the rooting elements of this thing, what we have in the tree here, this is no longer an internal node, and there's no longer any branching here. Okay, and so we end up with one less internal node and one less edge as a result. Any questions about that? How do you think that's obvious? How do you think that's confusing? How do you think that's boring? Okay, mostly. Okay?
Fair enough. Okay? So how do we count these things? Okay? What I want to claim is that if you want to, let's say, count the number of rooted or unrooted trees, binary trees, on N leaves, okay? The first thing I would like to say is that given any rooted any unrooted tree. Okay, you can construct a rooted tree out of it by raising any one of the internal, okay, so the root can be positioned at any edge, okay? We can take any one of these internal edges and raise it as a root to create a rooted tree, okay? What? I'm going to add a node, but that node is going to be of degree 2. Because notice that, that the root is a different node than all the other nodes in an unrooted tree. Okay? In fact, that's sort of, I guess, the whole point of this discussion here. Is that the difference between a rooted tree and an unrooted tree is basically the existence of one node without degree 2, okay, that we're assigning to be the root. Okay? There are no such things in the unrooted tree. There is one of them in the rooted tree. And the way that we can create it is, if we take any one of these edges and split that edge to insert a root there, pick that root up, the relative rootedness of all the other nodes is going to follow from that. Okay, is that sort of clear? Okay? This should sort of be clear to see. That if I take any one of these edges, I split it and lift it up, I am going to get, as a result of picking it up by the way that the tree dangles, it will describe the relative root orderedness, the directionality, the rooted directionality of all the other nodes. So that is a proof that for any rooted tree on, that for any unrooted tree on N leaves, there are 2N minus 3 rooted trees on N leaves. Okay? Any questions? Further, okay, if I have any rooted tree on N leaves, okay, I can make describe that if I have a rooted tree on N leaves, okay, I can create from that an unrooted tree on N plus 1 leaves that uniquely describes that underlying rooted tree. Why is that?
Here I've got a tree, 1, 2, 3. This is a rooted tree on N leaves. I can create an unrooted tree on N plus leaf, 1 leaves. That basically has a one-to-one mapping with the rooted trees on N leaves. Why? I'm going to create another species and assign that one to be the new species with the highest number of any leaf and hang that off the root. Now you had a rooted tree, okay? That meant you had one degree 2 node. Now it's a degree 3. If you give me this, a tree that was constructed in, an unrooted tree that was constructed in this manner, I can uniquely build a rooted tree from it by finding the highest number of leaf, cutting it off, lifting it up by this node, and shaking it out. So I play my improvement by injection between rooted trees on N vertices and unrooted trees on N plus 1 vertices. Okay? How many people sort of believe that? How many people don't believe that? Okay? Spending or don't believe that? Okay? Any questions? If you believe that, then what we now have are recurrence relations, which will enable us to count the number of rooted and unrooted trees. Okay? We know that the number of rooted trees on N vertices is, by the previous argument, okay, that there are, I can take any unrooted tree and lift, and there will be 2N minus 3 unrooted trees associated with it. So the number of rooted trees here is 2N plus minus 3 times unrooted. The number of rooted trees on N vertices is the number of unrooted trees on N plus 1 vertices. How many rooted trees are there on one vertex?
One.
How many unrooted trees are there on one vertex?
One.
We have a base case, we have a recurrence. Working through this, the number of rooted trees on N vertices is basically the sort of factorial function where you divide out the even, you remove the even terms. 2n minus 2n minus 3 times 2n minus 5, dot, dot, dot. Okay? What's the point of this? Well, if you plug this now 10 into this formula, you get that for 10 species there are about, okay, 2 million unrooted trees. 2 million is a number you can search through. So in principle, an algorithm for about 10 species, you could conceivably solve the pre-construction problems by exhaustive search. Okay? You could imagine an algorithm to construct all possible topologies. If you could kind of score to how well that topology matches the data, you could pick the best possible tree. But for larger numbers of species, the number of trees is going to grow so large so fast that it becomes impossible to do this by exhaustive search. By n equals 20 species, you have about 10 to the 20 different trees. Okay? Any questions? Okay? So historically, this was not much of a problem to biologists because usually they were only interested in studying the evolutionary trees for a small number of species. Okay? But now that you can get large-scale sequence information on lots of different species, you would like to be able to build much bigger trees. Okay? Like to ask, where do all the languages in the world fit in? There's 300 languages. Okay? Or how do all the bird species relatively fit with each other? You know, maybe there's 8,000 bird species. Okay? Any questions? Okay, good. So what is, just to summarize this before we really start to get into the algorithmics of this, what is it that makes building evolutionary trees a difficult job? The first thing is that nobody knows the underlying correct tree. Okay? Somehow if you want to reconstruct the history, you know, if you want to have an algorithm, you want to see how well your algorithm is working, it would be very, very good if you had data showing me what the right tree was. Okay? If I had a bunch of examples of here is the data, here is the right evolutionary tree, give me an algorithm to find it, you would be in good shape. But in reality, nobody really knows the underlying evolutionary tree for how dinosaurs, are, you know, how all the species were related, because only the dinosaurs were alive to see the earlier species. Okay? So nobody knows the correct tree, underlying trees. But the other thing that's true in understanding evolution is that many people have very strong opinions with it. Okay? If you go to a department of ecology and evolution, and in fact, there are lots of them. This is one thing I was surprised to learn. Okay? Most universities these days, including Stony Brook, have separate departments of ecology and evolution. In fact, Stony Brook was the first university to have a department of ecology and evolution. Okay? And in these departments are populated with people who study evolution, who are very interested, who have very strong feelings about what the right tree is in their favorite subspecies. Okay? And these evolutionary biologists spend a lot of time fighting with other evolutionary biologists about, no, lungfish should be here, not here. Okay? So there's a lot of emotion in here. And one reason why there's a lot of evolution is nobody knows the right answer. Okay? So any algorithm that's going to reconstruct evolutionary trees has to take into this into mind. Okay? Another thing to note is that the data that you're using, this distance data or these feature data, tends to be either noisy or error-prone, okay, or hard to interpret. We don't know that flying is a feature that really is difficult to evolve. Okay? So we don't know, I mean, in fact, if you think about it, birds evolve flying, insects evolve flying, flying squirrels evolved gliding at least. Okay? So, you know, pterodactyls flew. Okay, how many times was flying developed? Okay, it's hard to interpret. If you want to try to look at those distance matrices, how many millions of years of evolution separate humans from gorillas? Okay, you can make an estimate based on DNA, but there's going to be noise. Okay, so any tree reconstruction algorithm should ideally be robust in the face of this error. Okay. One problem that we're going to see when we study evolutionary tree algorithms is we're going to look over the next couple of classes at a few algorithms that are very simple and efficient and actually kind of pretty to analyze evolutionary data. The trouble is they're going to be assuming no errors in the data. Okay? And they can show that we can give you the right reconstruction if you promise me there's no errors in your data. Okay? Once they stop saying, I'm not going to promise you that, then most of the pre-reconstruction problems become NP complete. Okay? And so reconstructing evolutionary trees is a tricky business in that regard. Okay? Yes? What is right is saying that if you formalize a notion of what an evolutionary tree should be, so like, for example, one can minimize the number if you want to, so for example, we talk about this reconstruction character data, where your left side are all the species and your right side and the rows are all the species and the columns are all the features. And you want to try to design the tree so that it definitely evolves features the smallest number of times. If you promise me that every feature is going to be evolved only once in the right tree, then there's an efficient algorithm for it. The moment you let me reconstruct species features more than, you no longer have this perfect phylogeny, we allow features to be reconstructed multiple times, you start getting towards end-complete problems. Okay? So that's sort of what I want to say, that when you make a very simple definition of what the tree should be like, it is going to be polynomial, but once you allow more complicated things, definitions that are more tolerant of error, okay, the problems tend to become hard. Any questions? Okay? The other thing that is true is that if you look at the literature, there are literally hundreds of different algorithms that have been developed for building evolutionary trees. And in fact, the main software for building evolutionary trees is a package of lots of different algorithms. Okay? The problem is that all of these tree algorithms often will take the same data and build different trees. Okay? And so the usual methodology was that if you were an evolutionary biologist, you would take your data, run it through all these algorithms, identify which tree matched your preconceptions the best, okay, and then fought with the guy who had a different tree. Okay, now that's not the right way to do it, but it's somewhat understandable in a world where you're dealing with these kind of difficult problems. Any questions? Yes. The other thing is, if you want to think where on the sort of classical algorithm spectrum, where do evolutionary tree problems fit in, it's probably most akin to the problem of finding Steiner trees in graphs. Okay? What is the problem of minimum spanning tree? Well, that you sort of, I think, anyone who's taken an algorithms class would be familiar with. If you have a set of vertices, okay, and there's edges connecting pairs of vertices which have a certain weight associated with it, okay, maybe that weight would be a distance of how far apart were they? Okay? The minimum spanning tree was the tree that visited all those nodes with the smallest edge weight. But that's not really the nature, and that's a nice polynomial efficient algorithm, but that's not really what's happening in evolutionary trees. What you're really saying is more like you have a bunch of vertices. You have to construct intermediate Steiner vertices, okay, and find a way to connect all the leaves using new nodes, such that the total amount of work involved in connecting them is minimum. Okay? So this problem where you're allowed to create new nodes is called Steiner tree instead of spanning tree. Okay? And this problem tends to be NP complete, where the other one tended to be easy. Yes? Well, why can't it diverge into three or four or five species? Couple of reasons. First, if you believe that there is a speciation event that caused it, somehow what is happening, I think of a speciation event as being a mutation. Somebody didn't have it, somebody did have it. That's by definition a binary thing. Okay? So that's why it is binary. Now, what's probably, the other thing that is true, though,
is that quite often in certain populations, okay, evolutionary change is not somehow uniform. It's a sort of theory of something called punctuated equilibrium, which somehow suggests that a lot of speciation events tend to happen very quickly. The only reason you might think of a tree as not being binary is if there was a bunch of species formed so close to each other that that you can't really tell it apart, okay? Then you might end up with something that is not a binary tree, okay? So, bottom line, the actual process suggests it should be a binary tree. Even if it wasn't a binary tree, you could probably, if these edges have weights, you could model a four-way split. Okay, let's say that you have two couplets, and all of them have different numbers of arms, and they all go off and form their own species. You could remove that node out to be four by a little subtree with an intermediate node and say that the distance here is zero. Okay, we're very, very small. So forcing even that kind of an event into a binary tree does not really change things very much, especially if you're allowing weights on the edges. Okay, that's fine. Any questions? Okay.
We will. Yeah. What?
Why is it a Steiner tree problem? Okay, the real reason why it's a Steiner tree problem is because we don't know the intermediate species. Okay? So what is a Steiner tree problem in the real world? Okay, the classic example is soap bubbles. Okay? So what happens, you could imagine, if you take a bunch of, let's say nails, you have a piece of wood, okay, and you stick a bunch of nails out of it.
So here's your wood in the plane, you hammer in a bunch of nails, okay, and you dip this thing in soapy water. What ends up happening? Well, it gets wet and it gets soapy, okay? But what happens is the soap film is going to cling to some of these nails and form sheets, okay? And it's because of the physics of this, it's going to want to form the sheets with a minimum amount of surface area. Okay, that's sort of what nature is trying to do to minimize the energy of this. Okay? So Steiner trees allow us to introduce new species, new intermediate points. You don't necessarily have to use them. Okay? It's sort of saying that we want to try to find the, in this case, again, the, if you think about it, the leaf nodes are species. The edges, the length of these edges would correspond to, let's say, the distance from here to here might correspond to how many millions of years divergence was there from this to that. Okay? To naturally explain everything, you would want there to be as little total divergence as possible. Okay? Steiner trees allow you to, basically you want to connect all these points with the smallest amount of distance. By adding Steiner points, extra points, you might reduce that over the minimum spanning tree where you don't have the freedom to add these points. By definition, giving you the freedom to use these points, okay, you can't help but potentially win by taking advantage of that freedom. Do you always need to add Steiner points in the minimum Steiner tree? Not really. Suppose we were looking at 3 points like that were on a line in the plane. What is the minimum Steiner tree of these points? That is just going to be the same as the minimum spanning tree. But in any interesting configuration, you're going to want to, if you really want to shorten this, you're going to want to use intermediate points, okay? And likewise,
the most natural way to explain evolutionary behavior between a bunch of species, leaf species, most likely involves intermediate species that may no longer be there. Okay? Any questions? Okay? So that's why, again, that's why it's a Steiner tree problem. If you want to create the tree that connects the points with the smallest amount of distances, okay, you can get smaller distances by having intermediate nodes
if you allow them. Okay, the soap bubbles allow them. Okay, and evolution allows them because these species might have gone extinct. Okay, any questions? Okay, so that is the story of why evolutionary trees are. So you should be right now be at the point where you say, yes, I can believe that given data, you can in principle build trees. I can see why it is hard, and I can see why it is useful for there to be algorithms to do it. Okay? Any questions? Okay. So that said, let's start to take a look at algorithms for reconstructing trees from evolutionary data. Okay? I'm going to start working from the distance data. So here we're given as input, if we have a set of n species, we're given an n by n matrix. Okay? And we want to try to build the tree that somehow best fits that n by n matrix of distances. Okay? And in general, these distance reconstruct tree, distance data tree construction algorithms tend to represent, you know, bear a close resemblance to clustering algorithms. Okay? How did we do clustering of leaves? Well, again, when we talked about clustering, we had n items we were interested in clustering. We were given distance matrix measures between every pair, and we wanted to figure out what were the natural clusters that they fell into. Well, the standard agglomerative clustering methods that we used basically started at, you know, typically started at the leaf, okay, found the two closest species, merged them together, found a representative for the merged species, so half gorilla, half humans, okay, and now you had four species after you merged them. The half gorillas, half humans, the mouse, the birds, and the reptiles. You found which pair of species were closest again. You merged them, you merged them, you merged them. So the standard agglomerative clustering methods, basically we're building phylogenic trees, okay? And, you know, sort of the, you know, standard, a large class of the evolutionary tree algorithms are basically these merging algorithms, these neighbor joining things, okay? Where you start out with individual leaves, you merge the closest pair and generate a intermediate representation for that pair and keep going. And so the difference between these algorithms, a lot of the algorithms that the biologists have historically used, is how do you define nearest neighbor, how do you define what the centroid is, what the species that you get from merging these subpopulations, okay? And just like when we talked about evolution, there was, when we talked about clustering, there was single link, multiple link algorithms. There's a wide variety of algorithms of this type that I don't consider that interesting, but that are widely used. Okay? Any questions? So they tend to have ugly names like this, like UPGMA. That stood for unweighted pair group, okay, using arithmetic averages. The arithmetic average is how they were determining the value of the merged cluster, okay, and you pick the unweighted pair that was closest to it. Any questions? So these agglomerative clustering algorithms certainly yield trees. We use them to yield the clustering, and we use them to do clustering by noticing that if we broke the highest, cut the edges at the root or near the root, you got natural clusters. The problem with them, at least as far as I'm concerned, is although they yield trees, there is no particular criteria by which you can look at that tree and say this is the best tree according to that criteria. The trees that you get from these algorithms have the property that they are the trees that you get from these algorithms, okay, as opposed to being the best tree according to some fundamental property. Okay? And so the kind of phylogenic tree algorithms that the computer scientists tend to evolve tend to start by identifying a mathematical property that you want the tree to have and then identify the best possible tree of that type. Okay? Any questions? So that said, let's look at such a property. Okay? Any questions so far? So, one class of well-defined trees is something we will call a special type of rooted tree. We will call it, is something called an ultrametric tree. Okay, and an ultrametric tree is a rooted tree, just like the rooted trees we had before, where the leaves are species and the intermediate nodes have numbers on them. Okay, so every intermediate node in the tree is going to have a number. Okay, we're going to claim the properties that every internal node has at least two children. Two in a binary tree, you know, but again, in principle, it's not that much different if we allow larger than binary trees. Okay? Okay, and along every path from root to leaf, the labels strictly increase. Okay, so if we look over here, is this an ultrametric tree? Well, here it goes 3, 5, 8, that's getting higher. 3, 8, that's getting higher. Okay? So an ultrametric tree is basically a binary rooted tree with the property that the intermediate nodes have weights, and those weights increase along any path. Okay? Now, why is that increase along a path, does that have any interest as far as evolution goes? Suppose we interpret these weights as meaning millions of years ago. Okay? Now, this meant that that A and E split 3 million years ago. A and D split 5 million years ago. A and C split 8 million years ago. Okay? If we interpret that these labels as being, the intermediate nodes as being, the time when the speciation event, how many years ago that speciation event occurred, then it naturally makes sense that as you walk up the tree, these numbers have to be in increasing order. Does everybody agree with that? That you can't have the speciation event that happened, you know, 100 years ago, then above it was the one that happened last week, then the one that happened 10 million years ago. Okay? The times have to be monotonically increasing. The years ago have to be monotonically increasing as you walk up the tree. Okay? So if our data tells us for every pair of vertices, what is the number of million years ago since these species diverged, then by definition the tree that we get is going to be an ultrametric tree. Okay? And so an algorithm that reconstructs an ultrametric tree, in principle, reconstructs the kind of data given in this format. Any questions? Okay? So it should seem like a reasonable first class of trees to try to build. Any questions? Okay? So the distance from I to J in our matrix is going to be they represent the label, meaning the number of millions of years ago, okay, that the speciation event between them happened. Okay? Any questions? Any ideas how you can build such ultrametric trees? Okay, now people are pretty lifeless here. Suppose I give you this matrix. Can anybody think about inventing an algorithm? What? I give you a matrix saying for every pair of species, how many millions of years ago did they diverge? If I give you that matrix, can you build the tree from that? Okay, yes. Okay, so now you're going to tell me your algorithm is going to be, let's try to work it out from this thing. You want to say find the oldest. Find the most related one. So you want to claim that the pair, you find out which pair of species were there that diverged by the least, okay, and that diverged 3 million at the least amount of time, and they have to be equal to each other, okay? Okay, let's think this through if that's reasonable or not. It's not the way that the other algorithm works, okay? But let's think about whether that's reasonable. So you want to say that if you look at this matrix, you'll say, aha, B and C diverged 3 million years ago. Okay? So therefore, you're going to put a logical you're going to build a sort of a logical tree, no, that's diverged 3 million years ago. That has B and C in it, right? Okay?
And now you're going to do it perhaps again, because in this particular example, there were two such cases.
Okay. The other one was that A and E also diverged
3 million years ago. Now what do you do? That's a good start, but what do you do now? Okay. Next
hour.
What?
And look out from the and first find out the maximum weight surrounding this specific range.
Yeah.
So all those that differ the other one by maximum weight, I put into two different.
Okay. So you want us now say, okay, so again, the idea is now instead of working bottom up, you'd like to work top down. Okay? And you would like to say, take all of so how are you doing your initial split?
Initial split, right now I'm not defining it. I'm just defining it.
Okay.
First different, and the first difference will be like A, E, B will form a group and B, C form.
Well, let's take a look. So what is the, you're saying you want to have B and C form a group.
Yeah. And A,
so how look the, how do you look, given just the distance matrix?
Yeah.
How are you going to tell me that B and C?
So that A and B differ by 8.
A and B differ by 8.
That's the maximum.
The maximum, you're saying the maximum speed difference in here is 8.
Yeah. So A and so find all those pairs of nodes which differ by the maximum.
Okay.
And then so
okay, so now you're telling me that you say find all pairs that differ from the maximum weight. What are the pairs in this particular example?
So here first A will go into one and B will go into
another. A and B are one pair. Let's first list the pairs. A and B, what are the other pairs?
A C, B D, C E.
Okay, so given that these are all the ones that are maximum splits, if you do the partitioning, how do you do it?
So first, assign A to one group and B to another.
Say A and B have to be on different sides.
Yeah. Now A and C, so C has to go into B.
Say A and C are large. So have to be A, if A and C are large, they have to be like that.
Same way.
B and D. Okay.
A goes in the left side. And same way B and E, so E goes in the left side.
B and E.
So E goes in the left side. And
you have to confirm that they split like this. Yeah. And C and E, okay?
So right now I'm from two different groups.
Right.
So now what we do is like consider the induced graph of like A, B.
Right. Okay. Now what you simply want to do is now take the smaller matrix just on these species and repartition it here. Okay? Let's go. Okay, well, this one's working now. The bottom one up one is not yet, it's not working. Okay, yet. Okay? Okay, maybe make it work. Okay? But this one, I think this I kind of like, okay? Because I think we have a property here that we can sort of prove. Okay? We know that the initial speciation event had to have occurred the minimum, the maximum number of years ago. So we know that the maximum substrate had to be the max. We know what the value given the number of millions of years ago matrix. We know what the time of the initial creation of the world was. Okay. And now we also have this logical consistency that if the speciation between two things is 8, they had to be on different sides. Okay. So in fact, this is a perfectly correct algorithm. Okay, for doing the job. Not quite. It's actually worked by a simple. The basic idea is the algorithm I'll talk about on the slide. But this is basically the right the same idea. Okay, is we are noticing that we know what the time of the root is. Okay, and based on the root, we can now do this bifurcation. Okay, any questions? Okay. Now, why wouldn't we do this with any matrix? Okay, why do we know it had to be ultrametric? Yeah.
Well, it certainly has that property of these numbers.
Okay? Well, okay, right. Right, but we also have to rely on the fact that because the distances are strictly decreasing as we go down the tree, okay? That's what you're really relying on here, is the fact that the distances are strictly decreasing as we move down the tree. Okay? So we can't have another node here labeled 8. Okay? Yes. Right, okay. So it should be clear that this is a lot vulnerable to error if the distances are noisy. Okay? Because you're relying on the fact that you're separating events that happened, if you had some notes that were fairly close to each other. This thing happened 8 million years ago, this happened 7.9 million years ago. Okay? Your life is quite seriously shuffled and frayed. If you're now measuring this with error, the idea that you're going to be able to separate this from, with noisy kind of data, you're not going to be able to do that. Okay? So, the other thing this algorithm is assuming is consistency. That if there is an algorithmic tree, we didn't stop the moment we had split all the species. In order to check to make sure, we want to check to make sure that our data is algorithmic. We have to make sure that all the implied agents satisfy that division. Maybe that once we have defined a partition, that if there are three things here and two things here, that there are three times two agents with that distance. Okay, they are exactly these three times two. Okay? So after checking that the algorithmic tree is right, involves checking to make sure that this is consistent. Okay? But once we have that, we can recur on each side, okay, and build the subtree. So this will give us a correct algorithm for doing that. Any questions about that? Would that? How could it yield to a wrong tree? Well, if you think about it, you're relying very heavily in this case that for every pair of species, you have reached the decision that is separated exactly 8 million years ago. Now, if we'll say we're doing this based on DNA evidence, okay, how are you going to look at some species? You look at a dinosaur, you look at an administrator, you say, oh, they deviated 15 minutes ago, okay? How are you going to be making this kind of judgment? Well, one way you might make it is you have DNA species. Here you have the dinosaur DNA, here you have the administrator DNA. And you count the number of mutations that have happened. Okay? Well, how likely we agree that under such a model, it would make sense that the number of mutations between every pair of species here and here is about the same. The number of mutations between this species and this species is probably about the same as the number of mutations between this species and that species. But are you really going to bet that they're exactly the same?
So in that case, maybe instead of 8, we have a margin of 37.5.
Okay, now you're introducing some slot into your definition of ultrametric tree to cover up the fact that your numbers are not there. Now, it's very difficult to introduce a notion of slot here that is going to be consistent enough that you're still going to be saying, yes, I am coming up with what is rigorously the best possible tree.
That might depend on the thing.
Okay, now we were living before in this beautiful world of ultrametric trees, okay, which were well-defined things with these properties that made a lot of sense. If you give me the numbers for how long ago these things diverged and those numbers were right, this algorithm will give you the ultrametric tree, if one exists. So the question of recognizing, given millions of years ago data that is correct, can you reconstruct the tree exactly? Yes, we have a polynomial time algorithm for doing that. Okay? Now when you tell me you don't give me these numbers that they're exactly right, you can play games, but you're no longer dealing with the exact right tree. Yeah? Would the bottom-up algorithm have that property problem? The answer is certainly. Okay? Because you're still going to come up with, what you're saying now is, the bottom-up algorithm said find the closest pair and merge them, right? And you're saying, hey, I'm going to come up with the right answer here because I'm merging this.
But in general, your merging step is going to be
merge, because the hierarchy in the tray are merge this set of species with that set of species. Okay? For you to properly merge them, you're somehow going to want to say that yes, all the distances on this side are different than all the other distances on that side. Okay, that all these leaf nodes, okay, that all of these diverge at the same time from all of those. Okay, and now that you've got multiple measures that were taken independently, you're not going to get agreement if these measures numbers are drawn in a noisy way.
Okay, you can do averages, you can do smoothing and do rounding. Now you're no better than those evolutionary biologists who were busy doing agglomerative clustering. You're playing games, okay? So that's understandable, okay? And it's realized that that's understandable why they were doing it. The important thing to realize is that once we allow error here, you would like to construct somehow the rigorous problem would be, given the noisy values, construct me the tree that is provably the most ultrametric of all those trees. And your playing games with rounding and stuff like that and averaging is not going to guarantee you the best possible tree. When you rigorously state what you mean by the best possible tree, once you allow this noise, it's probably going to be an incomplete problem. Okay? That's the world that we live in. Any questions? Okay? So this is probably a good place to break. Any questions about, it's probably a good place to break. Okay, any questions? Okay, thanks for your attention. Next class, we're going to look at more algorithms, including starting to get to the character data, okay, which is the other class. Any questions? Okay, when are we going to have exams? The exam will be during the exam slot that you're scheduled for. Okay, that I believe is like the 19th or so of December. Okay, but we'll look that up. We'll talk about the exam the last day of class. Any questions? Okay, thank you. Thank you.